The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 8th of April, 2020, on Monocle 24. Hello, I'm Andrew Tuck, and you're listening to The Briefing, live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. Coming up...
I'm confident he'll pull through, because if there's one thing I know about this Prime Minister, he's a fighter, and he'll be back at the helm, leading us through this crisis in short order.
The UK's Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, continues to receive treatment for coronavirus in intensive care. But is the government being transparent enough about the PM's condition? Also ahead...
We pay for a majority, a biggest portion of their money, and they actually criticized and disagreed with my travel ban at the time I did it. And they were wrong. They've been wrong about a lot of things.
Donald Trump threatens to withdraw the World Health Organization's funding before quickly changing his mind. Monocle's affairs editor, Chris Chermak, will tell us about what the US president is up to. And we'll also be finding out how Mexico is trying to combat the virus. And our business editor, Venetia Rainey, will have a roundup of some positive stories from her beat too. All that right here on The Briefing with me, Andrew Tuck. Well, the UK's Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, is continuing to receive specialist treatment for coronavirus at a hospital in central London. He's understood to be in a stable condition, but he remains in intensive care and is unlikely to be running the government for any time. It means that the Foreign Secretary, Dominic Raab, is standing in for Johnson, but there are concerns that Raab is not up to the job, not least because he does not have the same powers as a Prime Minister. Well, I'm joined for more on this now by Monocle's contributing editor, Andrew Muller, and also from Zurich by Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé. Let's go to you first of all, Andrew. There hasn't really been any messaging from Downing Street at all today about what's going on. Why do you think there is this silence wrapped up around the Prime Minister's condition?
Because I'm not sure anybody really knows how they're supposed to proceed about this. As we've been discussing earlier this week on The Globalist and The Briefing, because of the UK's unwritten constitution, there isn't an order of succession understood in the way that there is in the United States and a lot of other countries. And Britain hasn't had to deal with a situation like this before, where a prime minister is potentially incapacitated for quite a lengthy period of time. Tony Blair, while prime minister, was in hospital a couple of times under general anaesthetic, but it was understood exactly what the schedule and the deadline was. Dominic Raab, as you point out, is now kind of prime minister, but not really, and that's where the difficulty is. He needs cabinet authority to make any big decisions. He doesn't, as we understand it, have the power to hire or fire ministers should he need to. He won't be doing the weekly audience with the Queen. So in one respect, he's kind of an old school prime minister, the first among equals in a cabinet government. But on the other, there are a lot of ambiguities about who is in charge of exactly what, which are going to need to be addressed if Boris Johnson is unable to return to his job for a protracted period.
And just tell me, Andrew, what's interesting, I guess, is, you know, that he's the foreign secretary, he's not the health secretary, so he's not exactly an expert on the world of coronavirus. Does that matter? And also, I wonder, when you step out from being amongst equals around that cabinet table, and suddenly there are colleagues that only a few months ago you were fighting for the leadership of the party who you've got perhaps some strained relationships with. How you, as you say, you don't have the same powers as a PM. How do you think he's going to operate in this strange new environment?
Very carefully, one would imagine, and one would hope at least that those potential and past and future rivals of his would realise at this point that none of that is what is actually important. If ever there was a time for cabinet unity, then this is surely it. But just in terms of the optics and in terms of communication, it is going to be very strange, not just because Dominic Raab is not the Prime Minister, it's that Boris Johnson is still a personally very popular Prime Minister. He is a known figure. He was the one who won the Conservative Party its enormous majority in December. He is, whatever reservations people may have about his politics, a very widely liked figure. And I think he was, in that respect, a reassuring presence at that podium to a great many Britons. And I don't think even Dominic Raab would claim that he possesses quite that stature.
Well, let's bring in Tyler across in Zurich. Tyler, are you finding the optics hard to understand?
It's difficult to watch, whether you're in a domestic setting where you gentlemen are, but also I think people are looking at the UK with a sense of disbelief. Here you have one of course, Europe's biggest economies. It's a G7 country, has a leadership position in NATO, obviously a key partner in all things transatlantic with Washington, even though, of course, there's been a few, I would say, speed bumps of late. So it's curious viewing, and I think as you kicked off here, it's we haven't really heard anything for about 24 hours now. We had a health minister saying something this morning that, and again, it's just this very strange language. You know, I understand that he hasn't been on oxygen and that, you know, he had a comfortable evening, but we're in this very strange limbo land. You know, is he you know, really in charge? We haven't heard from the man for almost a week now, and so I think it makes for very difficult viewing, and it just means there must be an incredible scramble job going on at number 10 and elsewhere in Whitehall, people not quite sure how to respond. And I think it does raise some questions. What is the true state of the PM's health?
And I do find some of the messaging from government ministers, you know, when Dominic Raab talks about he's a fighter, he'll be back. I think that's very unfair on many of the people who are bus drivers and all sorts of medical people who are dying in hospitals. The notion that if you're a fighter, you're going to make it out of this, rather than it's down to kind of the quality of healthcare that you're receiving. But Tyler, you sit in an environment where, you know, government isn't led by a big figure, where it's a more collective take on government. Do you think it matters for the UK, though, that we don't have a pivotal figure to guide us through some very complicated times when people are in lockdown, when they're having to make very difficult decisions about their livelihoods? Does it matter we don't have this figurehead?
Well, I think if we maybe rewind to the start of this crisis, if we would have seen that number 10 in these daily briefings, that there was a really solid core of ministers or advisors, people from the private sector, it doesn't matter where they come from, but had there been this really solid force, Andrew, I think it would have been different. Someone could have stepped up, but instead what we've had is a real revolving door of experts and so you haven't had that sense of stability. I think Andrew Mueller made a very good point yesterday that you know could we look at, you know, not that we might move into total coalition territory, but you know, is this a time for not, you know, not politics as usual? You know, could we look at whether it's, you know, Sir Keir Starmer, of course, the new Labour leader, stepping up in a different way? But I think there needs to be some type of critical leadership. Now, I'm not saying he's obviously going to step in on behalf of the PM, but do we look at something which, Andrew, we've been talking about, and I think you're referencing it here, you know, in Switzerland, where you have a country which is really run almost like a corporate board, and there's this real sense of stability, and you have continuity, and you know, you may not know who these people are, but you've seen their faces, and they represent, you know, they represent multiple parties as well, and they are there to govern the country. And it's an, you know, it's an interesting model. People have been saying maybe that's also the future for, you know, what a new US government might look like as well. Do you have a chairman who is really there to steer the board. And maybe you actually see a vice president in the future who behaves almost more like a president and is there for day-to-day operations. So I think something needs to give, and it'll be interesting to see what happens in this briefing today. But I think we need to see proper leadership in the UK. And also, of course, along with this, better communications, because I think people are wondering what is going on. Silence is not a great thing in these times.
And we'll just quickly bring you back in on this. You know, you were talking yesterday about, you know, should Keir Starmer be somehow brought into the kind of the government remit? Should there be some of the kind of the big guns from the past brought back into government? But just in this business, you know, this government not doing business as usual, do you think that would help? And do you also, it took me by surprise actually, how much of an outpouring of warmth there was from everybody about the battle that Boris Johnson was personally facing. Do you feel that we have almost edged into a world of national government where the old kind of rivalries have been put aside and actually everybody is a bit in a collective mind space?
It would be pleasant to think so, but in British politics in particular, those tribal rivalries run deep. I mean, they are actually tribal, and the Conservative Party would still be thinking like a political party. I think their big reservation about bringing in Sir Keir Starmer, of all people, is that he might look rather too much like a prime minister.
Well, let's bring in some other stories now. Tyler, you've been scanning the headlines and what's going on in your part of the world. And one of the interesting stories is, you know, that, well, you can tell everybody, because if you want to go out with your shopping trolley on a Sunday, bad news. You're not going to find much in Zurich unless you go to the Hauptbahnhof. But now they're suggesting that actually maybe this is a way of sneaking in Sunday shopping in Switzerland.
Well, I mean, it's been a debate which has been going on for decades. And of course, we can remember, Andrew, back to what, the late 80s, even early 90s, that even London was a city which was largely shuttered on a Sunday. Now, you know, it's changed across much of Europe, except in the German-speaking countries, somehow in Austria and Germany and Switzerland, that you still have retail is closed on Sundays, as you said, unless you go to a main train station or some type of transport hub, and then you can go and buy your groceries and your wine and all of those things. And what we've seen now, we've seen within certainly Zurich, the lead for the Chamber of Commerce, you know, alongside, of course, you know, pushing City Hall and the Canton, saying, you know, could this be the opportunity finally to, of course, allow businesses to somehow recover and make up for lost sales days as we look towards a lift? And also, is this a new way of also, you know, if we're going to get people to space out, if we're going to have social distancing, let's not have everyone crush into the stores on a Saturday. So maybe we should be looking at opening up on Sundays. Now, of course, Sunday shopping does exist in the run-up to Christmas. Extraordinary times that we're in right now. So it's an interesting move, because, of course, you know, many corners of government and certainly lobby groups have been pushing for this for a long time. So some might see this as a positive outcome to all of this, that we might have 7-day shopping here.
Well, it's so strange. As Zurich kind of makes some changes, the rest of the world feels like Zurich on a Sunday every day now. That's the strange thing.
It is. And it's like, it's an odd sort of contrast. And I think, and I have to say as well, we were talking about it this morning, saying, geez, I'm not really sure if I wanted to go back to sort of Sunday shop. Because, of course, if you really need to get some, yeah, you can go to the train station. But there is also something about it feeling a little bit sacred. And as you're saying, maybe we're going to come out of this and sort of think, God, you know, it would be so nice if you had those sort of, you know, quiet days again. So anyway, I mean, again, of course, be careful what we wish for, but it's interesting. If we look across the border, then I think there's something else happening, you know, which is quite curious. And that is certainly within Austria right now. We saw, of course, the chancellor's, Chancellor Kurz's government meeting this morning and the tourism ministers. And we were touching on this probably last week already, saying, you know, Andrew, do we now, of course, emerge into a new world where, you know, are we going to be, you know, jumping on a plane to go to the Maldives? Is that going to be what you want to do with the family when it's a school break or whatever? But what we've seen the Austrians saying is, you know, a little bit of not scaremongering, but, you know, we have to be sort of careful when we look beyond our borders, etc. You know, where are you going to take the family this summer? why not stay on the lakes or within the mountains of Austria? And I think you're going to see this is going to be a big, big focus of tourism agencies and tourism ministries around the world, really encouraging people to stay home, of course, to stimulate their local economies. It's going to be difficult for people to come in and maybe just, jump in the car, jump on the train, jump on your bicycles. But perhaps, much better to be spending your euros or francs or pounds within the national frontiers.
Very nice if you're in Italy, but here in the UK, I think some of our beaches may still be wanting come August, September. But Tyler, thank you so much for joining us. That's, of course, our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, who's in Zurich for us. And you heard from Andrew Mueller. We let him escape during my and Tyler's chat there. But he's out in East London, dialing into Monocle 24 as well. And thank you to both of them. Well, Donald Trump threatened to freeze American funding to the World Health Organization yesterday. Trump claimed that the UN body had missed the call on the coronavirus pandemic, but then he quickly changed his mind. It's led many to conclude that the US president has been attempting to detract from his own handling of the outbreak. Well, let's get more on this now with Monocle's affairs editor, Chris Chermak. Chris, welcome to the show. First of all, just tell us, what is the American government's beef or Trump's beef with the World Health Organization? Why does he accuse it of being pro-Chinese and not of helping the cause of clamping down on this virus early on?
So in terms of the comments that he made yesterday, I'd say it's a playbook in some ways that he's used before, right? He talked about that the WHO is an international organization. It receives vast amounts of money from the U.S. It gets actually about 15% of its funding from the U.S. And he criticized the WHO for a number of different little things, particularly for the travel ban, which Trump imposed on China. Which it is fair to say at the time was criticized by many people around the world, and you could argue was actually the move that should have been taken at the time. And yes, he just generally talked very much about them missing the call early on and that they were China-centric. And so as a result of that, he made this threat, or basically started by saying, we are going to put a hold on money spent to the WHO, and then he backtracked a bit when a reporter's question came, said, I'm not saying I'm going to do it, we're going to look at it, we're going to look at funding, but repeated that basically everything seems to be very biased towards China at the WHO. He didn't get into that many specifics of what exactly that meant, but I think a big part of his focus was on them missing the call early on, and there is something to be said about that.
And also on that, when you read through the criticisms that are out there about the World Health Organization, there's also suggestions that, when Taiwan very early on flagged the World Health Organization that there was something happening in Wuhan that they should take notice of, that they were slow to react because of the one China policy that, the poor old Taiwan doesn't really kind of get a look in and is ignored on many of these issues. And also a sense, I guess, that China is such a mighty country, it's very hard to criticize them. So even the whistleblowers weren't backed up by the World Health Organization. Too much pragmatic diplomacy going on. Do you think we should see a conspiracy, or is it just that world of, edging around the complicated world of diplomacy?
I think it's more to do with diplomacy than it has to do with conspiracy, but I think you're absolutely right that the WHO in some ways is not free of blame here. They do have to operate with the countries. China is a powerful country, and they don't have any particular enforcement mechanism, if you will, to get countries to bend to their will. In the case of China, it was interesting to look back and find the WHO also, as you say, they got reports, I think it was December 31st, that there were these cases in Wuhan. They only sent a team to China in mid-February, or sort of early to mid-February. And even that initially did not go to Wuhan. And as to your point with Taiwan, that's also sadly a very interesting case because Taiwan has been excluded from the WHO's annual gatherings. And as much as that hurts Taiwan, it sadly also arguably hurts the rest of the world because Taiwan has been very much on top of this pandemic. They actually have a lot of lessons to teach the world in terms of how to handle the coronavirus pandemic. And in some ways, they've been stopped from doing that because they are not a member of the WHO. So yes, it is very much tricky diplomacy. I think that's a key part of it. The WHO struggles to get that right, as do many international organizations.
Chris, just tell me, the World Health Organization, a UN body, headquartered in Geneva, what's its actual job now? Because I guess many are wondering what its role is in a day-to-day management of a global pandemic.
So maybe to go back to that point about China, this is where it's key, right? Because the key point that the WHO plays, a key role that they play, is when it comes to data collection and collating advice, if you will, for countries around the world. They were the ones to declare that this was, in fact, a pandemic, so to put countries on notice how they should change their approach. So they often tend to react, of course, based on the advice that they're getting from countries. The other key thing they do is providing technical advice. And this has been something we've been hearing often has been very central in combating the coronavirus. For example, they shipped hundreds of thousands or even, 1.5 million testing kits to countries around the world to help them try and get on top of this virus by actually understanding what was happening in each of their countries. But at the end of the day, as we say, it comes down to countries and the information that the WHO gets from them. It's going to have to work within that environment.
Well, let's see the role that they play over the coming weeks and months. And they put out some cautionary stories for Europe today as well. But Chris, thank you very much for joining us here on The Briefing on Monocle 24.
In turbulent times, it's important to stay focused on the bigger picture. And Monocle's been doing exactly that since 2007. Subscribe to the magazine today, as well as fresh ideas on business, culture, design and more, direct to your door. You can get a global perspective and unrivaled insights into current affairs, all without leaving your sofa. When you subscribe, you'll get a 10% discount at our online shop. And when this is all over, be the first to receive exclusive invitations to our events. Oh, and a free limited edition tote bag. As well as 10 issues of Monocle, you'll receive our annual specials, The Entrepreneurs, The Escapist and The Forecast. And for a limited time, there's 20% off. So what are you waiting for? Visit monocle.com and subscribe today using the promo code RADIO20. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Well, it's time now to get a roundup of the stories making headlines in Latin America. And I'm joined on the line by our correspondent in the region, Lucinda Elliott. Lucinda, great to speak to you. And we're going to dive straight in with a story from Mexico where the government has said no economic stimulus plan will be offered to ordinary people, to the country, but they are going to give a lot of money to back up the state oil company. What's going on here?
Yes, so unlike other governments in the region, Andrew, that are shedding out cash, we had Peru last week announce it's going to dedicate something like 12% of GDP to combat coronavirus. Mexico's government has said that there will just be no emergency economic package to deal with the pandemic. We had President López Obrador instead say that his administration will put more money towards social programs, but also, as you say, continue to prop up the heavily indebted state-owned oil company and continue the government's austerity campaign, i.e. not take on any debt, which other countries are likely and already doing to combat COVID-19. And all of this has been criticized because, of course, it is an incomplete response. You know, it's not taking into account the severity of the pandemic that Mexico and countries worldwide are facing at the moment. We already have, you know, their neighbor, the United States, announced this, you know, $2 trillion economic stimulus package. But Obrador wants to avoid getting into debt.
He's a popular leader. How has this news gone down? Are people with him in this crisis, or are they beginning to have some questions about his handling of it?
Well, Obrador, a bit like Bolsonaro of Brazil, has really been failing to take on preventative measures to combat the spread of coronavirus, namely these, you know, sort of stay-at-home quarantine measures. It's interesting that the two biggest countries in the region, who arguably had two of the most popular presidents ahead of this coronavirus, because of the way that they are actually dealing with it, they're receiving a lot of backlash from voters for not really foreseeing the potentially, you know, huge job losses, and how, in Mexico's case, how it will affect the poorest if some sort of preventative measures are not put in place.
The other interesting question for Mexico and many other countries in Latin America is when this virus spreads into indigenous communities, and that's beginning to happen in Mexico. And here, I guess the government often has less of a remit. Healthcare is even more stretched. What's happening in Mexico and elsewhere?
So in Mexico, actually, we have no confirmed cases of coronavirus among indigenous tribes. What we have are some tribes that are very close to cases in Oaxaca State, where we have several coronavirus deaths already. So they're now starting to learn hand washing techniques and social distancing, I believe, from local radio programs in their own indigenous language. But there are concerns about how they will be protected. In Brazil, where I am, we already have cases that have reached Amazon tribes, and there are fears that an entire population could be wiped out should no special provision be introduced to at least protect and treat them. And infections in Brazil were initially concentrated in very much more urbanized, industrialized states like São Paulo, but now we have cases in all 26 states. And that this is causing, a huge worry.
And I guess it's super complicated when you have communities who are based on collective living in shared residences or buildings together, to ask people to do social distancing as well. But let's move to Venezuela, a lighter story potentially. But the president there, Nicolas Maduro, well, like many people, he's taken to TikTok of all things. What's this story about?
Yeah, so in another extraordinary sort of only in Latin America development, Nicolas Maduro, who, he often takes to state TV, he has his own show, he's on the radio constantly. He's now announced this week that he's on this new video platform, TikTok, and there have been calls for Venezuelans to stay home. So people, I assume, they're on the internet a lot more. So I guess he's trying to reach them, maybe particularly younger sectors of the population through this new platform. But quite honestly, he's hugely unpopular. So who exactly is tuning in? I was actually tempted. So I had a look at what he was posting. We had a little taster about what to do with your family at Easter. Venezuela is still a big Catholic country. He was also encouraging people to stay home, the importance of family values, and then basically copying and pasting the broadcast that he would normally give on television via TikTok.
And just before I let you go, just tell me, you're in Brazil. We're seeing the headlines from Brazil every day, concerning headlines about how the situation is being handled. For you personally, in your community, are people practicing socialization? Are you feeling that it's working, the clamping down? What's your personal take on what's happening for you and your friends?
Well, here in Rio, where I am, we're sort of in semi-lockdown mode. We have been, for the past 3 weeks, but it's very difficult, Andrew, because of course, a lot of people work in the informal side of the economy. So yes, they've shut the beach, but then there are an awful lot of people who are walking along Ipanema trying to, sell you their coconut water and stuff on the actual seafront. So it has been particularly difficult here in Rio. Friends of mine who are in São Paulo, that's been a lot stricter, the lockdown. That's one of the biggest business hubs. But we're going to be broadcasting a special foreign desk report this week, little plug, which will all be about coronavirus in South America. So do tune into that, those who are interested in what's been going on here.
Well, Lucinda, thank you very much for talking to us. And a plug is always welcome on Monocle 24 for one of our other shows. So great to speak to you, and you're listening to Monocle 24. And finally, on today's programme, as promised, Monocle's business editor, Vinnie Shireni, joins me for a roundup of some of the other stories from her beat, with a more positive edge, actually. And she's back here with us now from Athens. So let's dive into this first story, which is about the rise of home exercise companies. We've been targeted in our homes for all sorts of things, to take our entertainment at home, to have our food delivered at home. But now health is the new frontier. You've done a big report for us in the upcoming issue. What's happening, Venetia?
So, yeah, as you said, the role that our homes play is really shifting. And, of course, home fitness is not super new. Anyone who was alive in the 80s will remember Jane Fonda and those leg warmers. But what we're seeing now is that companies are bringing sort of home fitness 2.0, so connected fitness. So most people think instantly of Peloton, for example, with their stationary bicycle and this video screen where you can tap into a live virtual Peloton and cycle with people all over the world. They have live leaderboards. You can high-five friends virtually. So it's that kind of thing. And there are a lot of companies moving into this space now. Some of them are startups, like a company called Hydro, which makes a connected rowing machine. There are other cycle companies. But there are also older companies. So, for example, Italian fitness equipment giant Technogym has been making this sort of equipment for years, for decades. It's been around since the 80s. But it now is also moving into that space of providing live classes through its apps and ways to connect through fitness so that even when you're at home, you can feel like you're socializing as if you're in the gym.
And it'll be interesting to see whether this lingers after the lockdowns come to an end, whether we stay exercising in our bedrooms rather than going back to the gym. Another kind of chapter in the saga of WeWork, they're threatening to sue SoftBank. What's the latest problem here?
So, yeah, it's not looking too great for WeWork. Obviously, they had huge problems with their IPO last year. That failed. They lost an enormous amount of the valuation. They went from $47 billion to $10 billion. Now what's happening is that SoftBank, the Japanese investment bank that has been one of its major backers in the past, has committed nearly $15 billion to the company in the past. It's backtracked on a $3 billion purchase of WeWork stock. And WeWork, that happened last week, and WeWork has now announced that it's going to sue SoftBank over that. It's a really big problem for WeWork because obviously at the moment they're facing hugely reduced occupancy. Some people aren't paying their rents. They have over 700 offices around the world and they've tried to keep most of them open unless ordered otherwise by the government. But they're getting a lot of backlash from companies who rightly need to cut costs themselves, and flexible office space is the first thing to go. So they're kind of on the brink of insolvency at the moment. They really need this cash. It would have also given them debt financing that they needed. So it's a big problem for them, and they're going to hope that taking it to the courts will solve the problem.
Now, we have our Entrepreneurs magazine coming out very soon. I haven't given you much time to tell us, but you've got like roughly about 30 seconds. But I did promise people some positive news. You've looked at some hero classes of companies who have already stepped up to the plate. What kind of businesses have you managed to look at here?
Yeah, so there are lots of positive stories, which is great. So the fashion industry obviously has stepped up and is making masks and gowns. Everyone's heard about that. But also, for example, in Singapore, family businesses have clubbed together to provide emergency cash loans that they can approve within about a day to struggling companies to try and bridge that gap between government funding that will take a few months to tick in. We've also seen Italian publishers clubbing together to cover delivery costs for independent bookstores so that they can stay alive. So there really are some silver linings out there, and it's inspiring to see. The Entrepreneurs magazine will be carrying those stories and plenty more.
Oh, yes, I know all about it, having somehow sent it to print from our various homes around the world at the weekend. So thank you very much for joining us. That's Venetia Rainey, our business editor. And if you want to know, I was alive in the 80s, but I didn't have the leg warmers. But I did know Jane Fonda from TV, so there you go. But that's all we have for this edition of The Briefing. The show was produced by Rhys James and Carlotta Rebello, and also by Yaline Goffin. And it was researched by Charlie Filmer-Court and our studio manager, well, that was David Stevens. The Briefing is going to be back tomorrow at the very same time. I'm Andrew Tuck. Goodbye, and thank you very much for listening.